Adesso.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, February 13th, 2017, and I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be continuing our conversation about the Health Systems Division, the Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames, any stuff to get us started?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, just a couple housekeeping things. This presentation is posted on us on the 9th, and we'll be using it all week. Tomorrow, in addition to this presentation, we'll have a grant. And after committee, Eric will be posting a number of things to OLIS, the first set of agency response to questions, LFO response to questions, and the LFO analysis for the grant tomorrow. But I will send you emails with links so you can go and find that material. Remember, response to questions always get posted back to the day that the questions were raised. Okay.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. This is Barsha Johan for the records, Chief Health System Officer for Oregon Health Authority. Let me start this morning with making sure that I do convey an apology to Representative Rayfield. I'll make sure I'm not ignoring anything or you today and answering all the questions. I felt terribly horrible about how I answered your question last week. So with that, to recap what we covered last week or the last presentation was, I introduced the Health System Division to you all with the vision, the purpose of the division, and went over briefly a very high-level picture of what are all the programs under the Health System Division. Today I'm going to cover two slides on the one system, which is our new eligibility and enrollment system, and then I will be passing on the baton to Director Leslie Clements, who's our Director for Health Policy and Analytics, who would be sharing further on who we serve, including our behavioral health needs, prevalence data, and Oregonians served by the behavioral health programs. To my left today is Melissa Hanks, who coordinates all the eligibility and enrollment information for the agency, and she will be, time permitting, she will be sharing details on Medicaid recipients and the caseload. So moving to our first slide today on the one system. Yes, on the one system, the Oregon eligibility system, known as ONE, was implemented on 15th of December 2015. As we all know, the system was brought in a very restricted time frame and with very minimum functionalities to be able to enroll our Oregonian members. The eligibility system is mainly based on income of the members who apply for the positions. Year 2016 had been an year of transition where there were a few things that we really tried to work on. Number one was to make sure that the member data is accurate. We are still learning that. As any system matures after its implementation, especially how we brought in the one system, it does take time to mature a system and understand what the system is all about and understanding the data. So that continues to be a transition into 2017 as well, where we are getting a better hold of what our numbers look like, what does the data mean, and henceforth so many questions. The second thing in the year of transition was, which was a successful implementation of the applicant portal. The vision of the One Eligibility System is that members are able to go online and apply for their eligibility and get enrolled. The applicant portal will further be open to the entire state by end of this quarter. The third thing in the year of transition that we continuously kept working on and will continue working on is identifying what are the build-out needs. Again, as the system came in with minimum functionality, we do need to continuously understand, learn the system, and plan our build-outs. And the another thing is, as we start to work with the Department of Human Services towards integrated eligibility, making sure that we are integrated into that system. There is a work plan and a budget in place that guides us towards the system optimization. The introduction of the new eligibility system led to a deficit of capacity to process significant increased workload. Since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid caseload has increased by 51%, which is from 626,000 to nearly 1.1 million individuals. We continue to work through several challenges, and I would like to share some of the challenges to this committee that are included in the work plan. I'm going to present these challenges by three main categories: people, process, and technology.
Dr. Sean, Representative Mueller,
thank you. Thank you, Chair. Could you go back one slide? How come eligibility is only based on income and not include residency?
Well, it is based on residency, but mainly we look at the income of the person who's applying. And Melissa, do you want to answer that?
Certainly. Members of the committee, my name is Melissa Hanks. I'm a policy analyst in the finance office at the Oregon Health Authority. We do base eligibility on several factors as required by the federal government. It is based on a residency in the state. There are requirements for citizenship for certain programs. Some programs require that people have a child on their case to be eligible for that program. But income is definitely a big one, of course.
That says only. Is that incorrect?
I think I understand the disconnect. For a long time prior to the ACA expansion, there were, as you know, various categorical eligibilities for Medicaid. In Oregon in 2009, when we passed Healthy Kids, that included children up to 300% of the federal poverty level. But historically, it's been things like pregnant women under a certain poverty level, people with disabilities. There's a range of other categories that are what are considered federal categorical categories. After ACA expansion, it basically was straight income and citizen. Well,
and residency.
Well, yes, but I mean that's the underlying premise that you have to be an Oregon resident who's eligible, and then after that, the only criterion, not your physical condition, not your age, not any other underlying issues. It's simply, are you potentially a legal recipient of Medicaid, and what's your income?
I know, but that says only on income. So if that's either an error, we need clarification.
Go ahead. Can I help?
Ms. Cohen, please.
You're stealing my thunder.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics. So this is one eligibility system, just one. And there are actually other Medicaid eligibility systems that are administered through the Department of Human Services. And those eligibility systems are primarily a combination of things that determine disability qualifications as well. When we opened up the Medicaid program to newly eligibles, it's primarily income-based. It's the slide, to your point, is probably not precisely correct, because anyone who's seen an application knows that it's really long and there's a whole lot of questions, including residency on it. So I would say, good catch, the slide shouldn't have just been only income.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
For clarity's sake, going forward, and I think it would be helpful, given that you do have, quote, more than one system, it would seem to me in order so that we have good clarity, that we actually have a definition of what's in all those systems, so that we know what the Oregon Health Authority has as far as eligibility with inside that system and human services. Because there was one time that we were talking about that we only had one portal, so that, you know, it would eliminate the confusion between what you're doing over in OHA and what's being done in over in DHS, because often you've got the same individuals and clients. So it seems to me that, and I hope DHS is listening, so that we actually get the eligibility for both of those systems or any other that's out there, and we can begin looking at overlap and duplication in those systems, or whether we need to go to one back to the conversation of having one entry into the system.
Okay.
So getting back to the next slide is sharing some of the challenges that we are covering in the work plan and the budget involve people, processes, and technology. I'm going to highlight just a few of them. Currently, the process takes average of 45 minutes to process an application. This is more than twice the processing of Cover Oregon application, which was 18 minutes on an average. Our goal is to bring it back to eight minutes per applications. We are working on several policy as well as system constraints so that applications can be processed end-to-end. There's a lot of manual work that still goes on in processing the application. Another important factor is, on the people part, is the turnover and staff motivation due to utilization of temporary and limited staff duration. So that has been a significant challenge as well.
Dr. Shahan, one of the conversations I've had with some people, and to be honest, I want to be clear, I'm not making a statement about what I prefer. It's a question about how do we handle it. You point out here that one is not capable of managing missing information. And historically, if I understand this correctly, and this is where I'd appreciate some clarification, if someone submits an incomplete application, the state has made the conscious choice to follow up actively with them and work with them to get the information they need to keep them going. That certainly results in more people being insured, and that's overall a good thing. Other states make different choices, and if someone has an incomplete application, they say, your application's incomplete, go fix it, and don't do a lot to actively pursue the person. At some point, I don't know if today's the right day, but I'd be interested in a little bit more conversation about that policy choice and the pros and cons of going in that direction. I'm certainly very supportive of getting as many people insured as possible. I'm also supportive of personal responsibility. So I'm interested in that conversation a little bit and how much of a difference you think that would make to our enrollment.
Co-chair and members of the committee, I will definitely make sure we bring that information back.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I add?
Senator Witters.
And what would be the cost differential? Because there is a cost implication to all of this.
Right.
And so you might want to, particularly in this particular budget environment. So if you could also give us those numbers as well.
Senator Winters will definitely include that as well. Moving into some of the process challenges that are in the work plan include the significant amount of manual workarounds that continuously slow down our process speed and accuracy. We are also working on improving the response time to process improvements that are required in the system as well and any needed complex policy changes as well. From the technology perspective, we just talked about missing information. We're working on that, working around the workarounds that are created as we work on the various functionalities of the system, how people are working on the applications. Again, trying to understand the technology part is something that we are working on. The work plan also includes trying to pull accurate data and identify the actual number of applications that need to be processed. Finally, there are lots of system changes which are slow at this time and require significant resources and support. We continue to need the resources to implement this workflow and address these challenges that I just shared. And with that, there are some successes as well.
Before you go on,
sure.
I just want to be really clear. So I know Ms. Miller is no longer with the agency. Who's managing this project now that because she was really responsible for running that project primarily, right? She was sort of project lead on getting one up and running. Who's doing that now?
So, co-chairs and the members of the committee, Sarah Miller was the project director to implement the one system, bring the system and implement it. Once the system was implemented, it moved to the second phase, which is maintenance and operation, which has moved back to Oregon Health Authority. Recently, one of the successes were as our business IT director, Wayne Haddad, who is here back in the seat, and the project has now transitioned for the optimization and maintenance and operation to our business IT director. So he's the one who will be leading that effort in Oregon Health Authority at this time.
Thank you.
With that, I would like to transition to our director, Leslie Clements, to share further on our who we serve and our behavioral health needs.
Hi, good morning. Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics. I'll try to keep this pretty brief. Director Saxon reviewed some of these slides with you at a high level. This first slide shows our total enrollment into the Medicaid program in Oregon called the Oregon Health Plan. And you can see that one of four Oregonians are covered under the Oregon Health Plan. I'm going to ask that you just go ahead and switch to the next slide, because this is where I think you can see what changed. So before the Medicaid expansion, we had about 600,000 individuals covered under Oregon Health Plan. Post-ACA, we've been teetering around 1 million people in the plan. To Senator Steiner-Hayward's earlier point, the composition of the Medicaid program in terms of the characteristics of who's covered dramatically changed. Historically, Medicaid was really built on two factors, and that was that you had to fall into a category. Either you had to be pregnant and poor, you had to have some level of disability and be poor, but you couldn't simply be poor, especially as an adult. Now, children had a different pathway because of the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, and they could be income-based only. So the new expansion population brought in mostly young adults, those between ages 19 and 64 that had been previously locked out of state Medicaid programs across the country. So that was the biggest change. The other thing was that a lot of people were pre-ACA trying to anticipate what this population looked like. And we were looking at existing programs where we covered individuals with state general fund dollars. So there was an assumption and projection that many of the individuals who were currently served in our behavioral health systems at 100% general fund match would then move to Medicaid, where they would actually have part of their costs covered by the Medicaid program. That, in fact, we believe has happened, and many of the individuals who used to be just served by state general fund dollars only are now enrolled in the Medicaid program. They're young adults, 19 to 64, who have some mental health issues. The other thing about this population is that I think, and again, this was mostly national, is that states projected that this population could be really, really expensive. And this population actually turned out to be healthier in the aggregate than we anticipated. And that resulted in a lot of those rate changes that Oregon has experienced over time.
Senator Winters.
I'm trying to track you when you said, you know, the 100% state match, and it's 19 to 64, and then you included in that a large population was mental health, and then now I'm hearing you tell me that they generally are healthier.
Yeah.
So the mental health population is healthier.
Right. Yes, Senator Winters, members of the committee. That population is in the mix, but I think Oregon had projected that we would have about 200,000 new individuals when, in fact, we had 400,000 individuals.
I want to go back to the statement.
Yes.
That the statement of health. I want to go back to the statement that, one, mm-hmm. that this population was healthier, and entwined in your statement is also mental health. So I'm trying to, in my brain, mm-hmm. trying to bring the two together, particularly since we've had this discussion on this panel and others of how we're going to serve and bring in behavioral health in with physical health, the mental health population.
So I think there's a couple things. If it was just the individuals with mental health and only those, I think we would have seen a population that cost a lot more. But in fact, with the expansion, we drew in a lot of individuals that were just low income without disabilities. So instead of a 200,000 increase in enrollment, we received a 400,000 increase in enrollment. So while we did draw in individuals who had high needs, we also drew in a much healthier adult population than anticipated. You look puzzled. Can I further help?
Maybe it would just be helpful if we just got a matrix of that population distribution, because I can understand that the younger are healthier. I can't understand when you're talking about some of these other mixes with the younger population, and I also understand, you 19 to 64, so right. You haven't really gotten in beyond 64 in the chronologically advantaged group.
Right. Beyond 64, we're talking about a Medicare population. So the primarily, you'll see some in the dual eligible population. In terms of the MAP difference, it might be interesting. I think this is where you see the income change. So the colors and the intensity of the colors reflecting the percentage of the population that is now covered by Medicaid. You'll see that it changes a little bit from the pre and post expansion period of time. And that's simply a reflection of really the percent of those counties that have higher populations in a poverty level. So the degree that they're very dark indicates an economic environment that's less favorable to those that are in the lighter shades. So, and in the context of the Medicaid population, we still have in the population those that are in fact there because of their disability, are administered by the DHS programs in the home and community-based services. And we also have some behavioral health services, I think, Senator Winters, to your point, that have elements of their benefits that are carved out because they're not considered Medicaid benefits. So I'm going to flip us to the behavioral health slide for just a minute. Wanting to draw your attention to the top two areas, the suicide rates in Oregon that Director Saxon reviewed, and also the opioid use. Both of those areas are included in the state health improvement plan that the Division of Public Health administers, and they have some very precise targets in terms of where we need to improve, how we need to improve. I think Oregon is in a good position to really devote a lot of direct attention to its opioid issues. I think you'll be hearing a lot more about that. There is a grant that Oregon recently received, and it provides us with some extra tools for addressing that problem. In terms of the mental health system, I think you'll recall that Director Saxon convened a behavioral health collaborative last summer and represents some 45 to 50 individuals who came together with all different levels of expertise, service providers, consumer advocates, to really tackle why our behavioral health system isn't producing the level of results that we're expecting. Access is not good, it's late, and really hammered through a series of recommendations about how we can improve that system. That report will be published shortly. We're going through a tribal consultation period of time. We'd expect the tribal consultation to result in some kind of an addendum to certain areas where recognizing their sovereign nations and that they have some unique needs and have some unique authorities. But I think primarily
Senator,
I can wait at the end of
that. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
I think primarily what came out of this. And this was actually, it was a very grueling process. And I was frankly amazed at the dedication of each of those members really hammering through some really difficult topics, because it really was, how do counties and CCOs come together? How do we bring in the Justice Department? How do we bring in schools? And the recommendations that came out provided us with a roadmap of how we move forward with some governance and shared accountability. The execution will be the telling point, of course. It's a proposal and a plan, but it was well endorsed by all those members, and frankly, getting everybody on board with a clear path was challenging. But I think we've got a really good opportunity now to take that next level dive to really integrating the system in a way that the members can experience less fragmentation and better access. So I'm looking forward to having you all see that additional report. But I think that's really good news for us. I think we've made significant progress there.
I just had two questions.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The first was, I had the opportunity to meet the other day with the Oregon Association for the Deaf, who is putting forward a series of recommendations around unique mental health care needs for deaf and hard of hearing mm-hmm. individuals. Have you had the opportunity to meet with them and engage them? I know during our tour it was very difficult for deaf and hard of hearing to access because the captioners and signers didn't show up, right. So they weren't able to participate. And I'm wondering what the Health Authority has done to reach back out to that population.
Yeah, I will have to get back. I don't have the answer to that question. I can tell you that we've learned from some of that experience in terms of those public meetings. So on a different effort, we had our CCO listening tours with the Oregon Health Policy Board and had interpreters and at each of those meetings. And so I went to sites before the meetings were convened to make sure they were accessible. So we've got a series of toolkits now that we use so that we're more inclusive. But I am not aware of that group coming to the Behavioral Health Collaborative and making any special recommendations. So I'll follow up and see what I can find out for you on that.
And the second question was just talking with folks on the Behavioral Health Collaborative and following the materials, I was a little bit concerned about what appeared to be a lack of integration of the information that was gained from the consumers. I mean, the collaborative being primarily providers and professionals in the system. And the year before, we had made a pretty significant investment talking to about 800 consumers who describe a very different system than the providers do. And I know I heard from some just this morning who were concerned about lack of recognition of the importance of peer services and a lack of endorsement of the importance of peer services in the materials coming out of the Oregon Health Authority. And that clearly was the single strongest theme that came out of that listening tour. So I wondered, how does the Health Authority plan to address that and really honor the voices and the time that was invested by those hundreds and hundreds of Oregonians experiencing mental health and addiction needs?
Senator, co-chair, Senator Gelser, members of the committee. So I attended, I think, all but one of the behavioral health collaboratives and heard that consumer voice very loudly. I think that the behavioral health collaborative also heard that. Peers' supports were extensively discussed, and I think what we're looking for is, in terms of executing these recommendations, an opportunity to bake some of the requirements into both the county and the CCO contracts to make it really clear what the expectations are. So I would say my sense is that we did hear the consumer voice very loudly. I think there was every single meeting, there was that voice expressed and time, and we also, I've never participated in any other planning document that had everybody's hands very actively editing it and re-editing and really making sure that at the end of the day we had something that really reflected that you know, this is not just a bureaucratic document, which at one point I think people said, this sounds like a really state bureaucratic document, but that it reflects the need and the urgency on behalf of individuals with mental health issues and substance use issues. So I'm hoping that you'll see that when you see the final product.
And I appreciate that. I just think sometimes it's difficult for consumers in a process that is very, no matter how welcoming or well-intentioned people are, I mean what I've heard from consumers is that they are not seeing their voices reflected adequately or adequately heard, and it's difficult to hear that in that process. And I think there's a sense of expectation that was elevated by inviting people into that process through the mental health tour. And I think that there is work to do in the execution and maybe in the writing so that the offline response from the consumers isn't, we weren't heard and we're not seeing peer services as valued.
Great.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your patience.
Co-chair. I wanted to just step back to the last slide. You don't have to go back there if you don't want to. But you mentioned that these counties are kind of based on economics within the county and the amount of people that are in the workforce, up to 40% have jobs now with the expanded population. Does the OHA look at things like hub zones, enterprising zones, business stimulators when as a population and kind of overlay that to the counties to see if there's success and if it can be a cost saver for the state to have those kind of programs in place and utilized, and if not, why not?
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, I think what we're doing right now is we're doing a lot of economic analysis of what the impacts of the ACA have been. I don't have any knowledge of your suggestion, but I'm glad to kind of hear more about it and see if we're pursuing any of that. I don't know of that off the top of my head, but I do know we're looking at everything. We're looking at the economic impacts by county, trying to understand what happened, what exists today. So if you have some suggestions, I'd be glad to meet with you and follow up and pursue. We are working with the state economists, and we actually have a health economist at the Oregon Health Authority who has been enormously helpful to us at this time. So,
okay, I'd be happy to follow up with that.
Okay, great. Okay, we can move to the next slide. This gives you a snapshot. This is probably not sufficient really to go through the level of detail that you'd like to in terms of, you know, who is this population. But we rely on prevalence data, and these are strictly estimates of numbers of individuals in Oregon who have mental health issues, who have substance use disorders. And you can see that there are some overlaps there. It does reflect that of our total population of 4 million people, that we're looking at almost 1 million people who have some degree of mental health or substance use disorder. So it's a significant amount.
Senator Winters.
Can you break that? Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you actually break your numbers down to the county level?
Yeah, co-chairs, Senator Winters. One of the, I would say, from my perspective, and maybe it's just a geeky policy perspective, that has come out as a product, it's the behavioral health map, and I'm sure you've heard Director Saxon talk about it quite a bit. We had contracted with the Farley Center in Colorado, and they've taken that map and have made it into just an incredible tool that by county you can go through and click on numbers of individuals receiving services, what types of individuals, are they adults, are they children, the services that exist in their area and funds. So I think it would be great if we could give you a demo of that information and provide you with that tool so you can see all that data.
Follow up.
Yes.
As a planning tool, it would seem to me that if you were able to actually break down your data down to counties, and also where there is gaps in service delivery, all in, you know, one document, as well as, and I think I mentioned this last week, the outcomes. What we don't know, and I don't know if you as an agency knows, what's working and what is not working. For this particular population, particularly with your dual diagnosis and what have you. And so if you have that ability, I think it would be helpful to share that knowledge with this body, particularly as we look at the whole issue of finite resources. Yeah.
Appreciate that, Co-Chair, Senator Winters. We will pull together some information for you. It's the intent of that tool to do exactly as you've indicated is. So what do we have? You know, what's the need? What do we have? What's the gap? How are we going, you know, where are the outcomes being produced? I would say we're not there yet. I think we're on the path for getting there, and we can give you some of that information.
Follow up, Madam Chair, because a part of that also will be what kind of boilerplate contracts are you looking at going forward to assure that the providers that you're contracting with actually do the performance that you are paying them to do?
Great. Okay. The next slide, and I think this is the last piece. These are actually, so what you saw in the previous slide was a prevalence. These are actually pulled from our systems that show what has been used. You can see that I think bottom line what this shows is we're missing a lot of people here in terms of those that are actually accessing Medicaid-covered mental health services, those that are accessing other, and when it says non-Medicaid services, these could be benefits and they could also be, you know, people. So there's certain gaps in our system because of the various funding streams. But I'd say this gives you a really high level. I think a deeper dive is more informative and would welcome the opportunity to have a presentation to the committee on that deeper dive information.
I think we should definitely consider that. Thank you.
Any questions? I think we'll turn it over to Melissa Hanks, and she'll talk about the breakdown.
Excellent. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. I am so excited to talk to you this morning about the breakdown of Medicaid recipients and the caseload. We're going to look at some charts and graphs, and I am going to talk through them and tell you what you're seeing, and then we'll take questions after that. So get ready for lots of awesome graphs. So this first slide shows you the approximate federal poverty levels for Medicaid eligibility. As you can see, we have several different programs in our medical programs. We have pregnant women and infants, and that goes up to 185% of federal poverty level. Children ages 0 to 18, now this category includes both the Medicaid children and the CHIP children under the Children's Health Insurance Program. The FPL for Medicaid children is 133%, and the federal poverty level for CHIP children is up to 300%. We do have a program for parents and other caretaker relatives. This program used to be related to our Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And that is approximately 40% of federal poverty level, and people in that program have a child in their household on their case. The age, blind, and disabled programs use Social Security income as the measure for federal poverty level. It goes up to 250%. For the Affordable Care Act adults, this is part of our Medicaid expansion population. The FPL is 133%. And just to note what the income is approximately for 133% of the federal poverty level, it is approximately $32,000 a year for a family of four.
What is it for an individual?
Yes, thank you for that question, Representative, co-chairs and members of the committee. It is approximately, for one individual, $16,000 a year. We do have a breast and cervical cancer treatment program that is for low-income, otherwise uninsured individuals who go to one of our screening clinics and become eligible for treatment for those conditions. It is up to 250% of FPL for that program. And we also have programs for our qualified Medicare beneficiaries. We the acronym is Quimby for them, but I'll talk it out. And specified low-income Medicare beneficiaries. Now, these are individuals who have both Medicare and Medicaid, and the FPLs are 100%, 120%, and 135% for those different programs. Yes?
Do you have you run the numbers to see how many individuals in Oregon would lose their Medicaid eligibility because of the increase in the minimum wage?
Yeah, we have those numbers. Actually, we ran them last year, but yeah.
And over time, what that would be as it scales up?
Yes, Representative Buehler, co-chairs, members of the committee, that is an excellent question. That's not information that I have in front of me, but I'm happy to go back and find it and bring it back to you and follow up.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, when we were trying to price out the minimum wage bill, the agency did do some work at connecting up employment data and Medicaid recipient data. The problem with our data at that point is it was before we had one data really clean. We couldn't usually connect kids to families. The system data wasn't good enough. So the trouble is, without knowing how many kids are in the family, you can't tell for sure if an adult would come off the caseload as wages increase. And the other issue is you can't tell how hours worked might adjust. So it was hard to come to really firm numbers. Clearly, the direction is that in some cases, people would come off.
I get that, yeah. Yeah, but I bet you could give us a range. You could do a sensitivity analysis, building in some of those variables.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Thank you, Representative. We will look into that. Thank you. Does anyone have questions about this chart before we move on?
Actually, I do have one question. So to go back to what Dr. Shahan was saying earlier, the one system deals with which of these groups, and DHS's system deals with which of these groups?
Thank you for that question, co-chair, members of the committee. The one system very specifically determines people eligible for Medicaid based on what we call modified adjusted gross income methodology. That was implemented as a new methodology at the same time that we implemented the Affordable Care Act. So the folks in these programs who would go through the one system who would be considered under MAGI income requirements would be the children, the parent caretaker relatives, the pregnant women, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and the ACA adults. All of these other programs are what we would call a non-MAGI determination, which means that they would be considered under different requirements.
Thank you. We good? Okay.
All right. So this next slide shows you our Medicaid caseload up until our most current data point. And then, as you can see, around the January 2017 area, that is forecasted enrollment going forward. So let me talk to you about the different fun blue areas on this chart. The dark blue line at the top of the chart, that shows you total enrollment in all medical programs. The darker blue area at the bottom of the chart shows you enrollment in the traditional Medicaid programs, so the programs that were not ACA expansion. And then the lighter blue area shows you enrollment in our ACA adults and standard population. So as you can see in this chart, You can definitely see where the Affordable Care Act was implemented and took effect in January 2014 when we have a large spike in the caseload. A lot of the volatility that you see in the caseload between January 2014 going into approximately March 2016 is a result of the data issues that we had from the Cover Oregon system and the many workarounds that we agreed with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to put in place to ensure that people had continuity of coverage.
Yeah, Representative.
I'm puzzled that you think that there is going to be such little volatility for the next 2 years.
Thank you, Representative Bueller, co-chairs, members of the committee. This is our caseload forecast, and so a lot of the volatility that you're seeing in these years is largely due to how we had to handle annual renewals. So normally, in a normal year, everything's running on schedule. We perform a certain number of annual renewals. Now, due to the Cover Oregon system and some of the workarounds that we put into place, we either expedited people's renewals or we had permission from the federal government to temporarily hold them while we processed applications. So a lot of this volatility we've taken into account in the forecasting model, and we can control for it because annual renewals are now back on schedule.
So why would your forecasting model not accommodate changes in the economy, both good and bad? I think that if people get laid off or if their work conditions improve, they would, you know, move in and out of eligibility, or like we just talked about earlier, as the minimum wage goes up, that would move people off the rolls. So why a straight line for 2 years?
Representative Bueller, co-chairs, members of the committee, I am not a forecasting expert. On this, we do have a publication that is posted on our website. It is the fall 2016 forecast. It does take into account economic drivers.
Ms. Clement, do you want to?
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, I would suggest that we come back and we share that forecast information with you because it takes into it. I think this is a simplistic PowerPoint slide and probably does not reflect the variability. But these are especially for the traditional Medicaid population. We have tons of history to inform those forecasts that take into account all sorts of ups and downs in the economy. The new population, I think, frankly, we have less reliable data to anticipate what's going to happen to the proportion of the expansion population. But we can give you, we can share those additional, and there's a lot of detail involved in that may be informative.
Well,
yeah.
But forecasts matter. I mean, it's the first time I've been on Ways and Means, but I mean, the way you build these models, we've seen a couple multipliers that I'm concerned about. Just previous sessions, we talked about the inflation factor and the rationale for that. And now, another big multiplier is going to be the number of people, that you're projecting that will be eligible. And that doesn't look like a very robust number to me. So I think we have work to do here.
We'll look forward to some more detailed presentation.
Glad to do that.
Senator Winters?
I was just going to pile on. I mean, whether it is the expansion population or the standard population, you still have volatility. And we know that when the economy supposedly is good, employment is up, and what have you, that statistically the need for services in not only your agency but in the other human services agency should go down. And so if you're telling us that it stays static and it doesn't change, there's something wrong with your forecasting model. Historically, that has been part of the principle in forecasting, and I that was a good question that good representative raised, and I would suggest that you take and begin looking at your model, in your forecasting, you may want to tweak it a bit.
Go ahead, and then the agency can.
So I had a couple questions.
I'm sorry. I thought you were going to add on to Senator. Where did you want?
but I know I have questions.
Okay, well then hang tight for a second because they didn't get a chance to respond to Senator Winters if they wanted to add anything else.
Yes.
Sorry, Mr. Co-Chair.
Senator Winters, thank you so much for pointing that out. Co-chairs, members of the committee. The 2017-2019 biennial forecast average for our programs is forecast to be 5.4% lower than the previous one. So our forecast is declining slightly every year as we, or not every year, but twice a year when we do the forecast. So since the last forecast, it has declined. Our forecast is also based on current policy, so we are somewhat limited in how many future unknown events we can put into this forecast. But certainly, we'll be happy to follow up with more information.
Thank you, Representative.
The one thing I would just kind of follow up on Representative Bueller is you know, when you're getting back to him with the minimum wage stuff, it would be interesting to factor in how many of the pre-ACA population shifts into the actual expansion population with the enhanced reimbursement rate and how that would impact some of that as well, because I think that all goes together, right? And then the other thing I was kind of curious about is the redetermination process, which from my impression is that is, you know, officially done in March. And just kind of getting a little bit, obviously we've seen some, you know, decline in the ACA expansion population. I assume that was, you know, slightly due to the redetermination process. I've also been told that, you know, at least in this next caseload forecast, that we've had a little of an increase in the pre-ACA population, or people have shifted from the post-ACA or the ACA population into that. And just kind of what do we expect, you know, if you guys know, or kind of the trends that you're seeing and what we might expect in March.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, yes, you do make a good point, and we will get back with that information as well.
In the redetermination process. Yeah.
Just to be clear, I'm sure that other people in the committee have noticed that our sort of more categorical, if you will, eligible population increased substantially around the same time as our ACA population. And if I understand correctly from talking with the agency, that's because there were a bunch of people who didn't realize they were eligible pre-ACA until the publicity around ACA. And so there were a lot of people who came in, and then in fact, it's a little hard to tell on this graph because the gradations are small, but it looks to me as if the darker blue population, the sort of standard traditional population, actually has gone up slightly as the main population has gone down. And that's because of some of the redeterminations that have turned out that people were actually eligible under pre-ACA standards conditions but had applied under the ACA because that's the first time they may have realized they're eligible. And to point out to the committee that our match rate is substantially different. Our average match rate over the 2017-19 biennium for the ACA population will be 6%, and tonight us, 94%, the feds. But for our standard population, it's 37% us and 63% the feds. So it's great to get people on, but when they come on to standard, it's much more expensive for the state. So
it's for me to take a message.
Sorry. Okay, thank you for your patience with those questions, Ms. Hanks. Keep going.
Excellent. Do we have any more questions on this before we move on to the next one? All right. Last graph of my presentation. I can't make promises for anyone else. All right, so this chart that we're looking at shows you the breakdown of the caseload, and in the previous conversation that we were having about the caseload forecast and the biennial averages, this chart shows you how much those averages have changed since the last time we did a forecast. The orange bars show you what the biennial average was for each caseload in the 15-17 biennium. And the blue bars show you the biennial average caseload for the 17-19 biennium. Now, walking through these, you can see that the blue bars are shorter for the OHP, Children's Medicaid and CHIP, and the Oregon Health Plan ACA adults categories. And that is where a large amount of our caseload is going down, as you saw on the previous chart. The biennial averages are forecasted to be significantly smaller for these populations. And you can also see, as we were discussing before, we have the traditional Medicaid categories like old age assistance, aid to the blind and disabled,
disabled, and programs like that are forecasted to increase slightly in the next biennium.
Ms. Hanks, one of the things that strikes me about this graph is looking at the pregnant women, and it looks like that's actually a little bit, maybe it's a little hard to tell with these gradations, but I would guess that that number, that those bars represent about 20,000 people. We know that about half the births in the state are on Medicaid, and we know that we have about 50,000 births a year in the state, which suggests that that number should be a little bit higher. Are women who were otherwise eligible under ACA expansion and then become pregnant counted in the ACA adult population, or are they counted in the pregnant women population?
That is a great question, co-chair. Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, if we have an adult female who is in the ACA adults category, when they are pregnant and they report their pregnancy, they are automatically moved to the OHP pregnant women category.
Thank you. Okay. Good.
I'm sorry, I have one more note, looking at my notes. just as a reminder, so when you see these biennial averages changing in these individual programs, these aren't necessarily people who are exiting the system and leaving. People can transfer between these programs. So as we just mentioned about the pregnant woman category, individuals can transfer from a children's program to a disabled program. It just depends on the life changes and the circumstance changes. So some of the people who are exiting the caseload do definitely leave coverage at the health authority and our Medicaid programs. Those people may also be gaining coverage through the federal marketplace.
Cool. All right. Any more questions from Ms. Hayden? Yes, Commissioner Hayden.
When the population of the adult for the pregnant women transfers into a different category, do you switch their contact or their assignment to a CCO or DCO or open card?
Thank you for that question, Representative Hayden, co-chairs, members of the committee. My understanding of how this works is that they stay with the CCO if they are with a CCO. They may have an option to change to an open card if they qualify for that otherwise or they have some circumstances. But generally, when someone's with the CCO, we like to keep them with that CCO.
Does our reimbursement rate change when they transfer from the ACA population to the pregnant women population?
Senator, co-chair, yes, there is a rate change for those groups when they change into different groups.
So that begs the question, why are we switching them? I mean, pregnancy is a normal life circumstance, just like anything else, like immunizations for kids or anything else that we do as part of routine wellness care. So why do we switch them out of the ACA expansion population into the, is that federal law that we do that? Why would we do that?
So co-chair Senator Steiner Hayward, pregnant women and children's category has a more robust benefit package than the typical ACA.
Benefit package or match rate? What's our match rate?
I think our match rate is the same because these are all so. They're all ACA populations, so they get the same federal match rate, but they fall into different categories where their packages may be different, and especially pregnant women. If you look at our policies around pregnant women, especially in times of economic downturn when we've made adjustments like dental services being reduced, almost always the dental services for pregnant women are kept the same or made higher than the average adult that is not pregnant.
And Madam Chair,
co-chairs and members of the committee, I do have Kate Ness, who's our Deputy Director for Finance and Budget, who could definitely answer that question as well.
Good morning. Kate Ness with the Oregon Health Authority, Deputy Director of Finance. There are different match rates within the ACA population, so our ACA adults do have a much higher match rate than our pregnant women, so we do move them. Also, the services, there is an When it comes to the different rate categories, you're right, pregnancy is a normal part of life, but they also, for that time period, access more services. So we have a special rate group for the maternity payment for hospital births and stuff like that for a CCO to bear. And then they move back to the other one. It's how we set up our rates. And we can get more into the details of that
at another
time.
Yeah, if you could just get us a little bit more information.
But they do have different rates because of how, you know, what a CCO experiences and costs for that time period that the woman is
pregnant. I want to be sure we're talking about the same word, rates. You're talking about how much do we pay the CCOs.
Correct.
I'm talking about what's the match rate from the feds?
Oh, yeah, so Senator Sarah Hayward. The match rate for the pregnant women is at our previous match rate, which is the one that fluctuates with Title 19 around 64-ish%. Whereas the ACA adults is moving to the 95%, or just moved to the 95% this year.
All right, I think we need to have more conversation about this to understand it a little bit, and we probably shouldn't take up more of the committee's time right this minute.
Please. One other quick thing, the benefit package is the same for all adults and children at this point, so there's no difference. The only one that's different is CALM.
Unless they're pregnant? So that whole thing that we just...
I'm now even more confused.
Now I'm really confused. So there is not a different package for pregnant women. So therefore, back to Senator Hayward's question, why are we moving them?
So you have to go to the lower end match rate.
Thank you. Senator Gelson, members of the committee, we have to move them in order to adjust for the match rate with the feds, because the feds pay a different match rate for the different category.
But that's my point. I mean, so the feds require us to move all pregnant women into the other category, because that's like saying that pregnancy is different from any... I mean, it takes less money to care for a patient who's pregnant than it does to care for somebody who has a heart attack. We don't move those.
So, co-chairs, what I'd like to recommend, since we're getting different kind of pieces of information depending on our different perspectives, is for us to just pull this offline, and we'll go back, we'll nail it down, and come back to you with a definitive answer. And we'll talk about the funding, we'll talk about when people have to move, what their qualifying events are, and all that, and hopefully get it all nailed down for you.
Thank you, Senator Gelser, and then Senator Hayden.
And just to be clear, when you bring that back, just a basic question. I'm really confused because I heard pregnant women have a higher benefit and their dental coverage is protected, and then I heard no, they don't get anything different. And that's I don't understand how that's different based on perspective. It seems like it is or isn't.
Okay. Clarity will be helpful.
Yeah, just a comment. The OHA should be well prepared on this, because I have been quite active for the last 2 years on this subject, and I believe that there is a legitimate concern that we should look at how those populations not only get transferred and assigned, but their access under a panel of providers being available versus not being available is critical.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I would just kind of, there's the distinction between like the pre-ACA and then the ACA expansion, so it's very similar to why we move the ACA expansion back down to the pre-ACA and the categories that existed before and after.
Yeah.
So I think that clarification.
Okay. Cool. We'll keep talking about this and forecasts. Thank you, Ms. Hanks, very much.
Thank you.
Great information and thought-provoking. Clearly. What's next?
So, co-chairs and members of the committee, I would like to now introduce Janelle Evans, who is our OHA budget director, and she will be sharing more about the health system division budget by fund type, drivers and risks, and OHA Oregon health plan financing and spending as well.
Good morning. I'm Janelle Evans, Budget Director for the Oregon Health Authority, and I, too, have some exciting slides.
Donuts.
No, I have the healthy whole grain budget bagels.
The Cheerio.
Budget bagels. There we go. The Cheerios. Yeah. So this is a breakdown of the Health System Division's budget by program area. 94% of the costs for the Health System Division are for the OHP Medicaid budget. This includes the CCO and fee-for-service costs for traditional Medicaid population, our ACA expansion, and our Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP. 3% of the budget is for our behavioral health non-Medicaid services. This includes mental health services, substance abuse disorder, and problem gambling. And the last 3% of this budget is for our program support. This includes our eligibility workers and member services, our IT system maintenance and operation costs, as well as our provider services support. Further breaking down each part of our program costs, the OHP Medicaid is the larger one on the left. 76% of that budget is funded with federal funds. These are our Medicaid and CHIP funds. 7% is general funds. And the other funds in this category, I'm going to further break down on the next slide. And there are 17%. For the non-Medicaid behavioral health, the smaller one on the right, 60% is general funds. They have 2% lottery funds, 12% federal funds, and these federal funds are from the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant, also known as SAPT, as well as a mental health block grant. And they have, in this area, 26% of other funds, which I'm going to break down here on the next slide. So here is the breakdown on the other funds. On the OHP Medicaid program, 47% of the other funds come from hospital taxes. It's at $1.1 billion. 17% from tobacco taxes at $400 million. We have tobacco master settlement funds at 4%. Drug rebate and other miscellaneous revenues at 8%. And then there's also $150 million is a proposed insurer's tax premium that the governor's budget included. The 18% in orange is our what we call leverage and empty limitation. That one's a little bit more confusing. It basically is the budget mechanism because Oregon Health Authority is the single state Medicaid agency. So for other public entities that qualify for any kind of Medicaid matching funds, they have to flow through our agency. And so this is the mechanism that we use budgetarily to get that out to them. So they have to provide their matching funds so that we can prove to the federal government that there are state matching funds. Those aren't our funds. Those are the public entities' funds that are claiming a Medicaid match. So when they send us their money showing that they have the funds to match, we pull the federal match and then return their funds and the federal funds back to them. It's just kind of a confusing budget issue.
Thank you, Chair. Co-Chair. On the 47% hospital tax and the proposed insurer's tax premium, is there a correlation between the two? Are they setting aside some of the hospital tax and shifting there, or is that proposed insurer's tax premium completely separate from the calculation of the hospital tax?
It is completely separate.
And there is conversations about tweaking that hospital tax. Is that reflected in this proposal, or is that historical percentages?
Thank you, co-chairs, Representative Hayden. The revenue total here doesn't have any changes for the revenue. I think the governor's budget might change on how we spend those funds, but the total isn't reflected at any kind of change here.
I was under the understanding that there was a portion of that hospital tax that would become a permanent tax under her budget, and that some tweaking of the actual calculation, because that fluctuates with the hospital tax, there's a couple of decimal points that were left on the table, if you will, that we were talking about looking and revising.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. The $1.1 billion represents our current tax rate percentage estimated So that part hasn't changed with the new proposals.
And I would say to the committee that we recognize that this whole issue of provider taxes and assessments is complicated, and we anticipate having much more detailed information for this committee down the road as we get a little bit more clarity and have some better ideas about what options are available to us for that. So rest assured that we will be providing a lot more information at some point in the future when we have a more useful set of information to provide for you. Senator Winters?
Just a clarity, and perhaps you can provide us later with the I'm going to call it pass-through, your little orange category, and what are the organizations that you're doing that for? If you could provide us with a list of those, and then, you know, my preference is instead of that one point, unless we're talking about a tax on our general fund or our dollars, and I'm assuming that you're talking about the assessment that we do. Question, and that's like going forward, assuming that the federal language that which we use that little loophole to do this in the first place will remain.
Yeah, the things we have to assume about the federal government these days are sort
of... I'm just, that assumption when we did that, and I was the chair who did it, that little loophole that was there that we did, there is the assumption that that will continue. So this is predicated on the continuation of what we've done in the past without knowing, and I put that on the record because not knowing what may or may not come down. The other, and whether in those numbers that you have provided for not only that which becomes to the general fund or to help with the Oregon Health Authority, but that which was supposed to flow back to the hospitals. So if you could help provide those numbers for me, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly. On the smaller one on the right, breaking down non-Medicaid behavioral health, other funds, these include $59 million for tobacco tax, $14 million from the Tobacco Master Settlement Funds, 23% from marijuana. We have 5% beer and wine, and 2% from the DUII funds. Any questions?
We're good.
Excuse me. So for the next, couple slides, we're breaking down some of the outlining some of the major budget drivers. The Oregon Health budget is based on caseload forecasts and cost estimates projected for the upcoming 2 years. Because of the size of the budget, small variances in our caseload forecast can be a significant shortfall or savings within our budget. I just want to outline in our caseload forecast for the governor's budget. It is based on the fall forecast, the fall 2016 forecast. We will be getting a spring updated forecast here in the next couple months that we will be providing budget information for. I do have a slide coming in a couple minutes to talk about kind of the differences between the eligibility categories and the different match rates. I do want to highlight on the benefit package that we budget to reflect the current benefit package, but any proposed changes to that will, of course, affect the budget. We've been highlighting some of our revenue as one of our major budget drivers. The federal match rate I mentioned again, but I do have a slide on that here coming. Previous biennium have used one-time revenues to support the health system division budget. And then we also we have to watch for forecast changes within our other funds for tobacco tax, tobacco medicine, master settlement, and the like. Our cost per person is another area we have to watch closely. Our capitation rates for our coordinated care organizations can be a significant budget driver. We, for each calendar year, we have an independent actuary who develops and certifies those rates. And then the federal government also needs to approve those to make sure that they are actuarially sound and within the according to the federal managed care rules and regulations. Also, in our cost per person, we definitely are watching upward pressure on our pharmacy costs. And our waiver allows for continuing to stay within the 3.4% per year growth. and the last one on that slide is our one eligibility system, along with the MMIS, our Medicaid managed information system. We have to allow for further development in integrating the eligibility system. Excuse me. So this slide, I like this slide a lot. It's good for information to keep in mind. I don't think it's surprising for us. How you read it is in the first column we have the breakdown of our members, and then in the second is the spending that goes associated with those members. So you can see that 40% of our members are children, but only 22% of our costs in total are for children. And then you can see in the orange, the ACA expansion adults are 47% of our population and 53% of the costs.
Ms. Evans, and you may not be the best person to answer this, but when you look, for example, at the large orange adult segments, I would venture to guess that that 53% is not evenly distributed over the 47%, mm-hmm. if you will, right? I mean, we know that in almost every, there are Pareto rules that apply essentially to almost every situation. And do we have the capability to break down that larger block in any more detail to say, you know, if you look at the entire adult population that's represented by that 47% orange bar, what does that really look like in terms of expenditures? Can we titrate that out a little bit more precisely?
Yeah, definitely, Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward.
And it would also be helpful at some point to see some of the trend lines for those, because one of the promises of the Oregon Health Plan was that we would start to control some of those costs that are incurred, for example, by multiple unnecessary hospitalizations or emergency department visits. So seeing the trend lines, I think, would be helpful to this committee at some point as well. Thank you.
Yes.
I just have a question, because it was curious to me as to why the range for the adults was from 19, I mean, from a health perspective, from 19 to 64, when we know that the younger you are, that it costs you less than if you're talking about the chronologically advantaged group, and that starts before you're 64. I was just curious, yeah. Because we start getting into the chronic diseases, and what have you, we know that that particular group consumes more of the costs, you know, the cardiovascular and the diabetes and what have you. So I'm just curious as to why we came up with that wide spread, because that's a huge spread when you're talking about, cost drivers.
Thank you, Senator Winters and co-chairs. We can break it down further. I think we did it for simplicity on the chart. We do... our capitation rates, our CCO capitation rates, are broken down by different age categories. So we could provide that for you.
Yeah, I think some more granularity in general will be helpful on that. Thank
Certainly.
You.
Certainly.
think maybe if you're moving to a next slide, this might be a good place for us to break, unless your next slide is really short. Any final questions from the committee for today? Okay, if not, we're adjourned.